Faith looked unnatural with her black-dyed hair and the oversized gray dress her foster mother insisted she wear at all times, along with a pair of heavy black boots that she kicked off whenever she walked to town, preferring to go barefoot. People considered her to be the oddest of creatures. A well-mannered girl, sure enough, with unnatural raven hair and pale eyebrows, who always had her nose in a book. When she wasn't reading, she was talking to herself, reciting recipes to make certain she wouldn't forget them. Be true to me, T, a boon for lovers. Travel well, T, a tonic for good health on a journey. Frustration, T, which granted good humor and cheer even on the outskirts of Kings County. Clairvoyant tea, concocted from mugwort and rosemary and anise, which helped the drinker see beyond the curtain of the here and now. And Faith's favorite, courage tea, which provided bravery and grit and was made of vanilla and currants and thyme. Every time Faith recited a remedy, she felt a thrill, as if she were unlocking a door to her true self. Whenever she did so, the iron bracelets burned and chafed. But she had learned to ignore them, as a dog ignores its collar and a horse its reins. Faith was walking through town one afternoon on her way home from seeing the peddler, a treasured new book of Shakespeare's sonnets in hand, when she heard sobbing. A woman stood outside a small cottage with a tilted roof, convinced that her child would die of the racking coughs that plagued him. In that instant, Faith remembered a cure for this affliction. She'd only been 6 when she was taken from her mother, but she had always paid attention when the nameless art had been called upon. She ran back to the peddler and asked him for quince seeds and honey, which she heated on a stove in his wagon. "What is that supposed to be?" the peddler asked. Jack Finney had grown fond of this odd girl through his dealings with her, for she had an endearing sort of charm. In his travels, he always looked for editions of books she might favor. He was a Cornishman who'd come to this country with nothing after his wife and child had died of the pox. He'd wanted to be as far away from England as possible, but now he felt lost in this vast, flat land of Brooklyn, and it was a pleasure to speak to someone with whom he felt at ease. As far as he could tell, the girl was an outcast, just as he was, a loner by nature or by design. Though she was now 11, and had lived at the end of the world for nearly 3 years, she was less a child than anyone of her age the peddler had ever seen. She spoke with assurance and without the vanity and self-centeredness of childhood. Faith bit her lip when she was thinking and narrowed her eyes, and now she paid strict attention to the concoction on the stove. "It's a remedy," she told Jack Finney. "If you let me have one of your glass jars, I'll tell you the secret." She went on to teach him how to cure a cough. He wished he'd been aware of this cure when he'd had a child of his own who'd been ill with a similar disease, heartbreaking to watch when at the very last his daughter could not draw a single breath. Finney gave Faith a jar with a cork top for her mixture. "How did you learn all this?" he asked. Faith shrugged. She remembered bits and pieces, and sometimes whole spells, but the truth was, she'd been born with the knowledge. She returned to the house where she'd seen the crying woman, then knocked at the door and told the distraught mother that a spoonful of the tonic given twice a day would stave off the boy's coughs. The woman was suspicious, but after Faith went on her way, she tested the cure by tasting a spoonful herself. There were no ill effects, so she gave a dose to her son. His coughing stopped that very night, and before long he was out and about, healthy as anyone. The women in Gravesend took note of the child's healing. Though Faith was only a girl, they began to seek her out. Perhaps she was too young to be a proper witch, but she seemed to have a natural talent for the nameless art. In time, people in need knew where to find her, within the cemetery gates on Friday evenings, the traditional time for working love spells, mirror magic, health tonics, and potions for reconciliation. Faith often suggested castor oil, milk, and sugar, a children's tonic her mother had fixed in Boston, along with summer savory for colic. She made most use of the recipe for fever tea, to nip high temperatures in the bud, made of cinnamon, bayberry, ginger, thyme, and marjoram. Faith climbed out her window, no matter the weather, as soon as Martha Chase was in bed, for she hated to disappoint one of her clients, some of whom waited hours for her to appear and came from the far-off towns of Bushwick and Flatlands. Faith had recently bought a black book from the peddler to use as a journal. Finney had added a small bottle of ink and a pen, and she'd written down all she could remember from the nights when women in need came to her mother's door. How to end toothache and insomnia and skin rashes. How to cast away bad dreams and regret. How to make amends. How to find happiness. For her services, Faith was paid whatever a client might have. A bag of apples, forks and spoons, coins, pies, and once she was granted a pair of heavy black stockings. The payment didn't matter. What mattered most was that Faith was still herself, even though the iron bracelets kept her from using her full talents. She had to trust in what her clients told her, for she was unable to read the lines on their right or left hands, the first of which, she remembered, revealed the future you are given, the other, which allowed you to view the future you made for yourself. By now, Faith Owens had grown into a gawky, tall girl, and the iron cuffs dug into her flesh. She wondered if without them she might be able to fly far from here and find her mother. She knew the map of the sky and could chart the world north and south. She'd once known a man called Goat who could divine the stars and had pointed them out to her. Faith considered running away, but she didn't know the name of the place they had come from, so that she might return, only that there had been a bottomless lake nearby, and a water serpent who ate bread from her hands, and a wild black dog she'd found in the woods who never left her side. Most of those who came in search of Faith were illiterate, and the fact that she could not only read and write, but could recite passages in Latin and Greek that she'd taught herself, amazed the women of Gravesend. As it turned out, Faith had a prodigious memory and could recall the charms of Agrippa and Solomon that had been written down in Maria's grimoire. It was clear that sorcery was second nature to her. In New York, magic was not outlawed, and magic books were sold on the streets, hidden inside black covers, available at a high price for those willing to pay. It was possible to find copies of the Greater Keys of King Solomon, the conjurations and curses and spells written out by hand, explaining the knowledge and wisdom of that ancient king. The mystical alphabet, the mystical seal of Solomon, the pentacles of Solomon, along with the lesser key, a grimoire written by Cornelius Agrippa, a most secret explanation of the mysteries of mankind and nature, all could be found, if one knew where to look. Finney had managed to get his hands on a few of these books, but the prices he quoted to Faith were too dear. She had to depend on her memory and the notes she jotted down in bits and pieces in her black notebook. I am with the All, and the All is within me. The letters flickered on the page and then disappeared, but when she ran her hand over the parchment, she could feel them. In this way, alone and abandoned, shackled by metal cuffs she could not remove and pretending to be someone she was not, she began her practice of the nameless art. For one does not have to have the talents of a witch to be called to the art. She simply has to have the desire to see beyond what is right in front of her. Martha Chase had planted 30 raspberry bushes when they came to Gravesend, but the soil was too sandy, and one by one the plants had withered until there was only one spindly specimen left. Faith had been given her own patch of land, and despite the soil, Her garden grew so well, it would not keep within the bounds of the fence that kept the rabbits away. Rabbits were everywhere in Brooklyn, and there was a place near the sea where there were so many of the creatures that the land there was called Rabbit Island. There were deer and turkeys and all manner of wading birds and ducks in the marshes, but the land itself was fairly barren. It was a miracle that Faith's garden was such a marvel. She grew feverfew for health, rose hips and skullcap for healing, lavender for luck. She'd plucked wild black nightshade to start from seed. Martha spied it snaking out of the ground, its black flowers already in bloom. She saw Faith standing among the blossoms, her dyed hair blue-black in the harsh light, her lips moving as she recited an incantation to Hecate, the ancient goddess of magic, who held power over heaven and earth and sea. Martha watched and grasped at her chest. Despite all her efforts, she'd come to believe that Faith was permanently infected by her mother's blood, and even the iron cuffs were not enough to change who she was. The older the girl became, the more convinced Martha became that it was her duty to cure the child of her heritage. The daughter of a witch must be carefully watched. Once she planted nightshade, anything might happen. Three. In the month of June, Abraham Diaz went to bed, and he didn't get up again. At first he tried. Samuel and Maria held him under his arms and lifted him up. But he soon sank back down, shaking his head. Abraham had no strength and no appetite for life. He knew this weakness, for he had seen it in others. It came at the end of life. It appeared that a person was giving up, but it was an acceptance of the end. He stopped eating, even refusing a bite of his favorite chocolate cake, and what was even more telling for a man of the Diaz family, he stopped talking. That was when Maria heard the Death Watch beetle. She got down on her hands and knees to search beneath the furniture, then investigated the attic and every inch of the damp brick cellar, but she couldn't find the wretched insect. It continued with its clacking call, for once begun, the sound could only be ended by a death in the house. Samuel hadn't stopped the Death Watch beetle by stepping on it outside the jail in Salem. Rather, the beetle's death had foretold that Maria would not hang. This was not the case now, for the beetle didn't show itself, always a dark sign. She remembered Hannah searching the cottage at Devotion Field when she heard it, never managing to get it out of the walls no matter how she might try, for it predicted the day of fire and destruction, when she was nailed to her own front door and her house was burned to the ground. Maria turned to the book, reading the grimoire for hours, trying every remedy that might help the old man regain his vitality. Vervain, feverfew, nightshade, horehound syrup, none of it worked. As Abraham's condition worsened, Maria was willing to delve into the darker magic that practitioners of the nameless art were taught to avoid, though she could find no death spells in the grimoire. "That is not our business," Hannah had told her. "When you go inside darkness, the darkness goes inside you." She found the spell she was searching for at the very end of the book, on a page she had never noticed before. It was invisible without bodily fluid, but Maria could feel it there on the page, writhing, ready to be called up. She licked her thumb, then ran her damp finger across the page. The letters appeared in small, perfect script. "Do not use unless you must." When Samuel entered his father's chamber that evening, the scene he witnessed stunned him. They had never discussed where Maria had come from, or more importantly, what she was. Now it was clear. There was no mistaking witchery. Black candles were lit around the old man's bed, so many that the smoke scorched the ceiling and billowed into the corners of the room. A line of salt had been poured along the walls so that no evil could enter, and herbs were strewn over the bed. Maria sat before the old man, naked, slick with sweat. As she chanted an ancient spell so dangerous and powerful, the words turned to ash as she spoke them, and her mouth burned as she called to Hecate, the goddess of magic and sorcery and light. Avracadavra, I will create as I speak. I will force into being that which is impossible and illogical, all that is against the rules of men. A shield to prevent death, no matter how dark the results might be. Enough! Samuel Diaz seized Maria from the bed and covered her with a blanket. He stomped on the candles as if they were bugs, extinguishing the flames, then opened the window and waved the smoke out. At last, Samuel turned back to her. He wasn't often angry, but when he was, he burned. Is my father an experiment for your art? It's a cure. When I cured you, your father was happy that I did. Why can't you be? This is not the same. The only cure for old age is death. There are things you cannot change, that you should not change. We'll let him go, as he should. Samuel was right, and she knew it. What was forcibly brought back from death never came back as it was. One lived or died as fate saw fit. It was possible to shift one's destiny, depending on choices that had been made. But some things were meant to be. They had been written and could not be unwritten. Abraham Diaz's time had come. On both hands, his lifelines had reached the ends of his palms. Maria stopped fighting a war she couldn't win. She washed and dressed, then watched Samuel from the window as he sat alone in the garden, waiting to lose the last member of his family. When it was clear that Abraham was about to die, Maria intended to call Samuel to his bedside, but the old man stopped her. He placed a hand on her arm and managed to speak. The man who could talk for hours at a time, and had taught his son to do the same, still had some breath left. When a person was about to die, nothing could prevent him from talking if he had something to say. I need you alone, he told her. So you understand, Samuel. Maria sat beside Abraham to listen to his last story, and she wasn't surprised to hear it was about his love for his son. My boy was 11 years old when it happened, he began. While he spoke, he appeared younger, as if he'd gone back to that time. I will not begin to tell you how clever he was. Every father will tell you that about a son. But I will tell you that no one has as big a heart. The midwife told us so when he was born. She said it filled up his chest, and even before his birth, I could put my ear to my wife's stomach and hear it beat. It was so loud. I knew he would not be like anyone else. We were not home when the terrible thing happened. We had gone into the forest to meet with the owner of a ship, a man who swore he would take us far from the perils of Portugal. Everyone wanted to go to Amsterdam, and we were willing to pay whatever was asked. It turned out the man we met was a liar and took our most precious belongings, a strand of gold that belonged to my wife, a silver prayer cup, and two strands of pearls my daughters were meant to wear on their wedding days. We rushed back home, expecting to fetch my wife and the girl so they could join us in the woods. But it was too late. My wife was taken. My daughters were gone. I told Samuel not to leave the house, but as you know, he will never do as he's told. He went out into the square searching for his sisters and mother. Our family had come to Portugal from the city of Toledo in Castile, Spain, then known by its Arabic name, Tuletula. We thought we would be safe in this new country. We had paid a high price to enter Portugal. Our family had been forcibly converted, but we practiced our religion in secret. The madness continued, with auto da fé, mass murders of conversos. It was a world of black and gold, and then a world of blood. Samuel saw everything that day. The hoods they made our people wear, the lashings they gave them, the fires that burned. Flesh became ash, body became soul. Afterward, he did not speak. Not a word. We stole the ship we were promised with the help of our neighbors who were to travel with us. I murdered the shipowner and his captain. I kept the crew who would be loyal to us and killed the rest. I made them jump into the sea and had no compassion when they drowned. That was what my life had done to me. Samuel sat in silence with a navigator, a Jew named Lazarus, and that was how he learned to follow the stars. I thought he might never speak again, but he did, almost 2 years later, soon after his 13th birthday. He had become a man while we were searching for a place where we might be safe. We went to Brazil, but the Inquisition had followed the Portuguese to the new land they had claimed. At last we made our way to Curaçao, where people such as ourselves were allowed to live. We were in shallow seas when Samuel jumped off the bow. He yelled out, "Look, Papa!" I didn't even recognize his voice because it had changed. He was a man with a man's voice, but he still had a boy's joy. For on this day he recognized the beauty of the world. There he was, riding on a dolphin's back. I could hear him laughing. It was the day I had hoped for. I knew that as long as he kept talking, he would be all right. That is why I'm telling you this, Maria. Don't let him be silent. The old man had taken her hand in his. He still wore his wedding ring, for Jews had given such tokens to one another since the 10th century as a declaration of love and faith. His was decorated with Hebrew symbols for luck, fashioned out of gold filigree and blue enamel. It was his greatest treasure. He had worn it for so long he could barely move it past his swollen knuckle. Now, when he did, there was a deep indentation around his finger, the mark of his married life. He asked Maria to give the ring to Samuel, then told her that after his death he wished to be wrapped in white cloth and placed into the ground without a coffin, so that he might become one with the earth. He was accustomed to living on land. He had come to love New York, and the sea was only a memory. You never know what you want or need until you are old, for old age is a mystery that is impossible to unwind until you step into its maze. Thorn, blood, earth, love. That was the riddle that Abraham Diaz held in his hand. Maria wept as he was dying. Her tears burned her and left red marks on her face, and Abraham asked her not to cry. Instead, he asked for something else, a last wish that could not be denied, one he had been thinking about every minute of every day during his last months. He wished for her to take care of his son. "Of course," Maria assured him. "I mean in every way," the old man urged. "The way a man needs to be cared for, with all your heart." Maria laughed. "That is none of your business," she told Abraham in a firm, gentle voice. "Love is my business," he insisted. "Long ago I was an artist." "You didn't know that, and why should you? You don't know everything about me. That was what I did before I went to sea. I made the most beautiful marriage contracts that could be had. A bride-to-be would have her family pay any price for my work. I constructed them from a single piece of parchment that I cut into shapes and words with a small pair of shears. When the brides-to-be saw the documents, they wept. The grooms fell to their knees, grateful to be alive in the world. Believe what I say. I know about love." Maria was forced to lean close, for she could hardly hear him. His voice was a whisper. It was leaving him now. The light inside him was rising up. She opened the window so his spirit would be free once it left his body. "We are birds," Hannah had once told her. "They sit inside of us waiting to fly away." "No one can fall in love with me," Maria told Abraham. "Don't wish that on your son."
"I know love when I see it," Abraham Diaz insisted. "I see it in you."
He gave her his ring and told her the secret that he had learned about love during his time on Earth. Then he closed his eyes. He had nothing more to say. He wasn't even in the room anymore, not in Manhattan, not in the year of 1691, not in a house on Maiden Lane. He was with his wife,
when he first met her. How beautiful she was, with her straight black hair that was so long she could sit on it, or wear it wound atop her head so that she looked like a queen who wore a dark crown. When you fall in love like that, time doesn't matter. This was the secret he told Maria, the last words he ever said. What belonged to you once will always belong to you. Be grateful if you have walked through the world with another's heart in your hand. Abraham Dias was buried in the First Sherith Israel Graveyard near Chatham Square, wound in white linen as he'd wished to be, placed into his grave without a coffin, so that he might become a part of the earth without delay. He had belonged to a congregation of Sephardic Jews who had wandered the globe, searching for a safe place in which to live and die. They had found what they were searching for in Manhattan. The burial took place on a blue June day, and the achingly beautiful weather made the loss cut more deeply. It would have been more fitting had there been rain or hail or black storms blowing in from the sea, a world from which a man wished to escape. Not this perfect day. The women stood on the fringes of the gathering, their heads covered, and the men wore prayer shawls that their wives and daughters had stitched. The men joined in the mourner's Kaddish, the ancient Aramaic prayer Jews recited to honor the dead. Samuel Dias did not practice his religion, but with a borrowed prayer shawl over his shoulders, he too recited the Kaddish and sang laments in Portuguese, as his father had done on the night of their family's murder. Then he got down on his knees at the gravesite and wept. He had refused to shave, and his hair fell to his shoulders. He looked rough, but he cried more than any man the congregation had seen before. The unmarried women watched him, so moved by his raw emotion they felt their feet lift off the ground. How could a man feel so much? What else was inside of him? If only they could find out. If only they knew, a great mystery would be revealed to them. The married women gazed at their own husbands with disapproval, for the men looked away from Samuel's passionate display. It was too much for them. It was a story they had forgotten a long time ago, when they were 13 and became men and locked their emotions away so they might navigate the cruelty of the world. That night, the house on Maiden Lane felt much too empty. Samuel had torn his clothes, as mourners are commanded to do. For 7 days, he sat outside, even when it rained. He wept until his dark, handsome face was swollen. He had stopped talking, as his father feared he might. Instead, he began to drink rum, and he didn't stop, growing more silent and moody with every drink. When he finally came inside, Maria brought him his father's wedding ring, hoping it would start him talking. Samuel held it up to the firelight, squinting to see it more clearly. "There's a reason my father left this with you," he said.
"Because he wanted you to have it."
Samuel Dias shook his head. He knew the way his father approached the world, and he knew the meaning of the gift. This ring was a message, one he was grateful to receive. One he hoped Maria would accept. "No, he wanted you to have it."
Maria shook her head. "It's a family treasure. I couldn't possibly."
"If he wanted to give it to me, he would have placed it on my hand," Samuel said. "No, it should belong to you. We should do as he wished."
Dias knelt before Maria and slipped the ring onto her finger.
"This is what he wanted, for you to be mine."
She didn't wish to hurt him.
"It cannot happen if I don't agree to it, and you know I can't."
"But you have agreed. See? It won't come off." "We're married in my father's eyes," Samuel insisted. He was making a fool of himself, but he didn't care. "That's why he gave you the ring. That's our tradition." Maria attempted to slide the ring off, but it was stuck. Even when she took a bar of soap to the ban, the ring would not move past her knuckle. It seemed impossible. Her hand was so much smaller than Abraham's. The ring fits the person it should belong to, Samuel told her.
Are you trying to annoy me? Maria said.
Samuel shrugged. He didn't care if he was annoying. He'd certainly been called worse. I'm trying to tell you the truth. Rather than argue, they went upstairs. The bed was small, but it didn't matter. Rain began in the middle of the night, but they didn't care. Once more and then never again. That's what she told herself. But it was a lie, and her mouth burned even though she didn't say the words aloud. He saw that she wore the sapphire, and he laughed out loud. She was his. He was sure of it. Certainly she was his in bed when she told him never to stop. But in the morning, as they sat across from one another at the table, Samuel took Maria's hand and she drew away. She thought they had a tacit understanding. No love, no commitment, and certainly no marriage. He, of all people, should understand, for he'd been with her on her hanging day. You wanted me here last night, Samuel said. Was that a favor because my father died?
It was a mistake, Maria said.
Because of a curse? He was as outraged as she'd seen him. That's a fool's belief.
Because words have power, and they can't be taken back.
Samuel Diaz was a practical man. Yet in his travels, he had seen astonishing things he would never have believed could exist. Such miracles had changed him, convincing him that anything was possible in this world. He had seen golden lions sunning themselves on the rocks of the Barbary coast, whales with long, twisted horns floating under the sea, stars falling from the sky, parrots that could speak as well as a man, clouds of pink birds on the coast of Africa all taking flight at once, a woman with dark hair whom he wanted no matter what the cost. A curse can be broken, he told her, convinced that miracles were not so difficult to find. She shook her head and refused to agree. Causing him harm was not a risk Maria was willing to take.
Sell the house or keep it. I can find somewhere else to live.
Diaz talked for an hour, then two. He was good at it, and had learned from the best. He told her what it was like to stand in the woods and watch her on Gallows Hill. His heart had been ready to explode. It was a bird, he said, struggling to be free of the cage of his ribs to be beside her. But she told him that what was done could not be undone. A witch who cast a spell upon herself could not escape its chains with her own magic. No ritual she called forth could undo the damage. It had happened to her mother, and now it had happened to her. There was only one woman she had known who would have been capable of undoing such damage. And Hannah Owens wasn't there to break the curse. If your answer is no, then you stay here, Samuel told her. I'll go. He wished that he had told her he loved her before her hanging day. He wished he had admitted that as soon as he knew, when he thought his life was ending in Curacao and he realized that she was the miracle who had come to him. As they sat across from one another at the table, he gazed at her, doing his best to memorize everything about her. Her black hair, her gray eyes, the mourning dress she had worn since her daughter's disappearance, with its mother-of-pearl buttons, her throat, her moon-shaped fingernails, her beating heart, her beautiful mouth. There was much he hadn't told her, hundreds of stories, perhaps a thousand, and it pained him to think that it was quite possible that he never would. He should have told her the story of stumbling upon the magnolia, how he'd sunk to his knees and cried, overwhelmed by its beauty. He should have told her that while they were on the Queen Esther, he'd wished they would never reach Boston, and how he had worried over her fate in Essex County, and how he would worry about her still. He stood so quickly the chair skittered backwards and fell to the floor. If you tell me to go, and you mean it, this time I won't come back. Maria Owens looked away, and he had his answer.
She felt something pierce through her as she watched him go out the door and walk across the garden. Hollyhock, lilac, sunflower, lavender, thyme. There were all the trees he'd brought to her, each rarer than the next. If Abraham had still been among them, perhaps there might have been a chance for them. The old man was as persuasive as he was intelligent. As Samuel walked into the garden, he thought he glimpsed his father reclining in his favorite chair near the rows of lettuce and beans. But it was only a shadow. What was gone was gone. The ground was muddy, and the herbs and neat rows turned the air spicy and green. It was a good time of year to plant the tree he had brought from St. Thomas, ignored for as long as he'd been here, its roots wrapped in burlap, its leaves still coated with salt. It was not a magnolia, the one genus that might have convinced even the most contrary woman to fall in love, cursed or not. All the same, the roots of the tree of heaven would take hold long after the red flowers fell off and scattered. Samuel hoped it would tolerate the chilly climate of New York, and did his best to help it do so, choosing a sheltered place beside the barn, where it would be protected in winter. The mourning period had ended. For 7 days, Samuel had wept. He had torn his shirt and cut off his hair as offerings of his grief, which was twofold now. When it was time for him to leave, he did so. He left most of his belongings in the barn, for he didn't need much in the world. He didn't stop to say goodbye, and he didn't plan on returning. There was nothing for him here without Maria. Still, all the while he was gone, he would think of her, and wonder why, if she didn't want him, she had stood at the door on that seventh day. If she had been another woman, he would have sworn there were tears in her eyes. A witch's tears burn. They turn her inside out. They are not meant to be, and yet once they began, they were difficult to stop. A witch could drown in her own tears if she wasn't careful. She could scorch the ground beneath her. As Maria watched Samuel go, she was thinking of Abraham, buried a mile away, an expert on love, who had told her in the moments before his death that he saw love inside her. It looked like a dove, he said, but appearances could fool you. Some people mistakenly believed it was peaceful and calm, but that wasn't what love was. It was a wolf. If you open the door and call it inside, you must sink to your knees and say its name. You must do so whether you are cursed or not. That was the mystery Abraham had come to understand. Always and everywhere, love was the answer. Part 4. The Charm. 1691. 1. One morning, Faith awoke to the scent of apple pie, the fragrance so strong she could have sworn that her mother was in the kitchen, baking her favorite treat. She looked out her window to see that her foster mother had pulled up all the plants in her herb garden by their roots and was busily tossing them into a bonfire. Faith had carefully planted the ingredients for courage tea, currants and thyme, and now they were little more than twigs, along with all the rest. Martha hadn't worn gloves, and her hands bled, pierced by thorns and brambles. All the same, she ignored her wounds as the pious must, and stood close to the heat to make certain it flared. When Faith came into the yard, she was distressed to see her ruined garden. She let out a sob that chased the sparrows from the trees, and a wind rose from the sea, filled with stinging salt. Martha grabbed Faith's hand and surprised her by stabbing her with the small paring knife she'd used to cut down the stalks that now lay in shambles. 2 drops of black blood fell onto the ground, burning through the grass. "It's still inside you," Martha cried when confronted with this sight. After all she'd done to save the child, the girl was still tainted. She'd given up everything for Faith, her home, her house, her past. A bloodline witch could not be cured or changed or charmed or made to obey, even if she pretended to be perfect.
Martha went upstairs to search the girl's room, and soon found the black mirror and the notebook. She ripped the notebook into shreds, and when Martha broke the mirror, the glass shattered into 1,000 black pieces, one of which stabbed her directly below her eye, leaving a small deep mark, as if she'd been pecked at by the beak of a bird. From then on, the windows in Faith's chamber were nailed shut. Her door would be locked from the outside at night. "I'm saving you from evil," Martha said to Faith calmly, when the girl raced up the stairs to see her room had become even more of a prison than it had been before. "Will you do as I say?" Martha asked.
"Of course, Mother."
The words burned her mouth, for Faith was not a liar by nature, and she didn't intend to follow this woman's twisted rules. It was a Friday. Faith knew there might be women waiting for her that evening in the cemetery. Perhaps they would stay until morning's first light if she didn't appear and they were desperate enough. She sat on the floor of her room, a prisoner. And yet, even with the window nailed shut, she imagined the scent of apple pie, made with cinnamon and brown sugar, a treat her mother would make especially for her on every birthday. Her true mother, the mother she had lost, the one who told her to always be true to herself, even if she had to hide that truth from others. Her life in Essex County came rushing back to her due to the scent of apples. She imagined the woods where the ferns grew so tall, and the bottomless lake, and the serpent that would eat bread from her hand. She recalled her mother's voice singing her to sleep, and the doll the man named Goat had made for her, and the wolf who had slept beside her bed, and her own natural red hair before it was dyed with bark and ink. She remembered the women who came to the door at night, and the tonics and spells her mother created for them, often asking nothing in return. Apples were used in many of these charms, the seeds worn in an amulet, or a red apple itself pricked with a needle while the name of one's beloved was repeated. A woman was then to sleep with the apple under her palate, make a pie out of it, and feed it to the one she loved. Faith remembered the book in which everything she needed to know had already been written. It was that night, while locked in her room, that she realized if she continued to obey Martha, she would betray herself, perhaps even lose herself. She must do what she believed to be right. She would not spend another year pretending to be someone she was not. It was the last Friday of the month, and she knew the peddler would be in Gravesend. Perhaps he would help her. As soon as Martha went to bed, Faith took up a garden spade she kept hidden beneath her bed. She hit the cloudy window glass until at last it cracked beneath her touch. When she pushed it out, tiny glittering shards rained down into the garden. She threw down a satchel of belongings, then climbed down the vines, holding on to the prickly, twisted creepers. As soon as she touched the ground, she took off running. She knew where the peddler kept his wagon, and she rushed to the Indian path that led through the flatlands of Brooklyn, where he and his horse were settled in for the night. Faith gave him everything of worth that the women of Gravesend had given her. Frankly, it wasn't much, and when she handed over the silverware she'd been given, she worried that he might reject it, for it had all turned black in her hands. All the same, Jack Finney knew real silver when he saw it. He'd heard stories of women back home in Cornwall who turned silver black, and he knew what they were thought to be. But he was a practical man, and he stayed away from anything considered to be magic. He believed in buying and selling, and in taking good care of his horse, and in staying off the back roads at night, when robbers might be searching for a man such as himself, who might have a tin box filled with silver and coins. He thought Faith was quite calm for a child who was running away, but he could tell she was serious. She slept in the wagon, beneath an old quilt he'd picked up when a recently deceased woman's belongings were sold at a good, cheap price. When Finney woke in the morning, Faith had already been up for hours. "We have to leave right now," she told him. "We must be as quick as we can." Martha had fallen into a deep sleep,
and dreamed she was tied to a chair and drowned in a lake. She was turning blue, struggling for one more breath. When she awoke, she was drenched. Pools of water had formed on the floor around her bed. Some dreams connect to the past, some to the future, some to the very moment you are in. Martha went to Faith's chamber to find that the window was shattered. She peered outside to spy footprints in the sandy earth. They disappeared halfway down the road. Perhaps a wind had come up, or perhaps it was what occurred when a witch's foot wasn't nailed to the ground. She managed to escape. It was then Martha heard a clacking sound. It was somewhere in the wall, and when she put her ear to the plaster, the clatter was so loud she felt deafened. She went downstairs and the clacking followed her, mocking her, it seemed, tracking her like a dog, though it was nothing more than a black beetle that had come out from the walls. Martha grabbed her cape and left the house, the door swinging open behind her as she took off running. She wore the white bonnet she'd sewn years ago in Essex County, and she spoke to the Lord as she raced up the lane, for she considered herself to be doing His work on earth. She refused to lose what she had gained, and was ready to fight evil with everything she had. When she got to the Indian path, she saw the treads of the wagon and followed. Her breath rattled inside her. She had not come to the end of the earth here in Brooklyn to lose what she wanted most in the world, whether or not it rightly belonged to her. By now it was early morning, and the air was pale but growing brighter, throwing down bands of shadows and light. The peddler had stopped in the village to deliver an order of several bolts of cloth on his way out of town, for he would likely not be back to Gravesend for a long time, and the transaction, how much the fabric was worth was at issue, had slowed down their departure. Faith was anxious, her stomach a nest of nerves. As she waited, she bit off her fingernails, but knowing a person's nails and hair could be used in a spell, she swallowed the bits of her nails, then felt them scratching inside her. "That took long enough," she said to the peddler when at last he returned to the wagon. She already knew some things were not worth bargaining over, not when you were in a hurry, not when your future depended upon it. The air still smelled like apples, though there was not a single such tree in all of town, and Faith was aching to leave. She knew she was being called home. She thought of her mother's clear gray eyes and the song she had sung. "The water is wide, I cannot get o'er it, and neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that will carry two, and I shall row my love and I. Love is handsome and love is fine, and love's a jewel while it is new, but when it's old, it groweth cold and fades away like morning dew." "Don't worry so much," Finney told Faith. He supposed he had no choice but to escort her. "We're on our way." They headed through the flatlands as the seabirds were circling above the dirt road, dropping their breakfasts of mussels and clams so the shells would split open. Martha had been running through town when she spied the cart in the distance, as it was about to go over a small wooden bridge. She still heard the echo of that beetle in the wall, even out here where there was nothing but marshland. The sky was a brilliant blue, and foxes in the marsh were walking through the muddy shellfish beds, the vixens calling to their kits. Martha called out for the wagon to stop. When she shrieked, the foxes grew silent. "What on earth?" Jack Finney turned to see what he at first thought was a ghost in a white bonnet, her gray cape flying out behind her. "Good God," he said, for she looked a terrible sight. "Don't stop," Faith Owens told the peddler. She was changing the future right now, minute by minute. If she hadn't been wearing the iron cuffs, she would have seen the fate she had made in the palm of her hand, a path that led across a deep river. Though her sight was gone, her courage was not. She thought of the tea her mother often made her. "Never hide who you are. Do what you think you cannot."
"If that's what you're running away from,
I can't say I blame you, Finney said as he charged his horse to go forward. The horse was an old steed, one that had been treated cruelly before Jack Finney stole him, and Finney didn't regret his thievery for a moment. He'd needed a horse, and he'd seen this one being beaten by a farmer on the shores of Gowanus Bay. The beast had one eye and a resigned expression. Finney himself never used a whip. All he need do was say a word or two, and the horse was ready to comply. "Let's go," the peddler told Arnold, for that was the name of the horse, dubbed so because his shaggy white mane reminded Finney of an old uncle in Cornwall, a plodding, kind-hearted gentleman who could always be relied upon. Martha was behind them, doing her best to keep up with the carriage. "You're stealing that child," she called. "I'll have you arrested." Finney looked over at Faith, who was staring straight ahead, as if she couldn't hear the woman's voice.
"I'd hate to be arrested," he said.
"You won't be," Faith assured him. She was more herself than ever, despite the iron cuffs. It was freedom that gave her a bit of the sight. It was the wind and the clatter of the horse's hooves, and the opportunity to say whatever she pleased without being punished for her thoughts. It was simple enough to see this Cornishman's fate. He talked about his homeland in his sleep. "I've seen your future, and you live to be an old man in a place called Pennycumquick," she told Finney. He was a good man, and deserved good fortune. In fact, he'd been born in what the Cornish called Pennycumquick, a village on the Fowl River, referred to as Pennycumquick by outsiders. It was here that his wife and daughter had been buried, and his one wish was to return before he passed on, so that he might be buried beside them. He felt a chill along his backbone. No one on this side of the ocean knew where he'd come from. He thought perhaps he had a special little passenger. As a Cornishman, he understood there were those who had the sight, and this girl was obviously such a person. Whatever she was, he wasn't likely to let her fall into the hands of the shrew at their heels. He told Arnold to race. All he need do was to ask him nicely to please gallop, and the horse picked up speed. That was when Martha Chase tried to catch up, on the small wooden bridge where there was barely space for a carriage, let alone a woman charging ahead. Arnold was lumbering and huge, and there was not enough room for this woman to run past the carriage on the narrow bridge so that she might reach Faith. They heard her cry out, a sharp cry that chased the gulls from the marshes. The birds rose up in a flapping cloud of white and gray, circling in a swirl above them. There was a thud, and then the shouting stopped. Jack Finney called for the horse to halt, and Arnold complied, heaving from his exertions. Finney and Faith turned to look over their shoulders. Behind them, the bridge was empty. There were hundreds of gulls still wheeling through the sky, as they often do when they spy something that might make a meal. "Stay here," Finney told the girl. The peddler climbed down and walked back to the bridge. He had long legs, and he wore a brown jacket he'd had for nearly 20 years that had served him well. Finney was a rough man with a tender heart, and he had a lump in his throat. He didn't need the sight to know that something was wrong. He put a hand over his eyes, for the sunlight was bright, and his vision wasn't what it once was. The peddler was 40, but he let himself go, for he'd had no reason not to do so, and the fact of it was, he drank too much. All he saw below the bridge was the brackish water and the weeds and the black stones and the sand, and then he saw that the water was red. Finney went in, even though salt water was bad for his boots. He turned the lady over, but it seemed she was no longer alive. There was blood coming from her skull, a small trickle that mixed with the water in a red swirl. A shadow fell across Finney, and he gazed up to see Faith standing behind him, her face set. There was a white bonnet floating downstream. There was the woman herself in the water, exactly as she had dreamed it, lying in the shallows beside the cattails that were as tall as a man. Finney shook his head.
I told you to stay where you were.
I thought you might need help. Faith gazed down at Martha.
The bright light didn't bother her one bit. She could feel the cold water reaching up to her ankles. She didn't mind if her boots got wet.
I think she's gone.
Finney waited, but Faith was stone-faced. And when there was no response, he added wryly,
I can see you're broken up by the situation.
Faith was taking the opportunity to study Martha, something she had never dared to do before. She reminded her of the thin, tall, poisonous weeds that grew in the marshes and burned your skin if you tried to cut them down.
Shall we bury her? Finney asked.
If you want to live long enough to go back to Cornwall, I suggest we leave her where she is.
For an 11-year-old, Faith sounded very sure of herself.
If a sheriff is called, we should have the flatlands behind us when the body is found.
It's not as if we had a hand in killing her. She's done that all on her own. I suppose we should feel sorry for her.
She took me from my mother and locked me in a room. For 5 years, I've been waiting for this day, Faith told her companion. Finney felt it was their duty to honor the dead. He dragged the body to the shallows and set her on the watery bank beneath the bridge. It was the least he could do, even though she was heavier than he'd imagined, and he was sweating through his clothes. He felt as old as Arnold, who huffed and puffed at the end of the day.
Perhaps we should say a word or two, Finney asked Faith, once he'd scrambled back up to the dusty road.
The girl was still below the bridge, on the stony bank, the water running over her boots as she contemplated the scene before her. One of Martha's legs had been crushed by the wagon and was twisted underneath her body, her stocking torn off, her flesh white among the black stones. What you do comes back to you threefold, Faith recited. That's what happened to this woman. Faith had a pretty serious face, but that dyed black hair didn't look human and wasn't. She couldn't pretend to feel sorrow. Now that this day had come, it was no surprise that Faith had no feelings at all. It wasn't just the lines on her left hand that had changed.
If what you say is true, Finney said, this woman was evidently responsible for some terrible actions, for this is a terrible death.
She made horrible jam, Faith said, and she tried to have my mother drowned.
That's enough for me.
Finney felt lucky to have such a smart horse and an even smarter girl beside him. It was only now that he was in constant conversation that he realized how much he had despised being alone.
We can leave her where she is and let her discuss her actions with the Lord.
I'll take a minute, if you don't mind. Finney nodded and walked back toward the wagon. Faith stayed there beside the creek while he hoisted himself back on the carriage bench and took up the reins. It was then that Martha spit out some water, which trickled into the rising tide. Faith didn't move or shout out. She had been told lies for so many years. Why they had to leave on the ship to New York. How evil would find her if her hair was red. How her mother had never cared for her. Standing in the shallows, she closed her eyes and let the person she'd been forced to be go. That obedient girl Jane she'd pretended to be, who did as she was told. She breathed in the chill morning air, the salt stinging her lungs, and she might have forgiven Martha her wrongdoings, but she could not forget that she had been robbed of 5 years of her life. She would not allow another minute to be stolen. Inside Faith's mind, Martha Chase disappeared, a shadow growing smaller until it was the size of a wasp, then a stinging ant, and then no size at all. A spirit vanished. A death wish can be a powerful spell by witch or mortal alike, and Faith shook with the bitterness she felt and her willingness to ignore the rules of magic. If Martha wasn't quite dead yet, she would be by the time she was found, her eyes open, looking at the flat blue sky.
and if she was aware of her surroundings at the very last moments of her life, if the black beetle crawled out from the folds of her clothing, if she called out Faith's name, no one would have heard, for the seabirds were screaming like mad and circling above, and the tide was rising quickly, the way it does in the marshes, so that one moment it was possible to see a figure of a woman, and the next it seemed that a long gray dress was floating in the deepening water. Faith climbed up the embankment, then hopped into Finney's carriage. The soles of her boots were covered with muck and her stockings were soaked. The lines on her left hand were changing before her eyes, and she noticed a red splotch in the palm of her hand, as if Martha's death had marked her. She paid it no mind. The past was behind her now, and the future lay ahead. And yet she blinked back tears, not for Martha, but for all the years that woman had cost her. Finney wasn't the kind of man to speak about such matters. Anyway, the likely cause was the bright Brooklyn sunlight.
"Where are we going?" he asked, practical as ever.
Faith's mouth was set. She might be 11, but she was extremely sure of herself. "To look for my mother." Finney might well have argued against that notion. Brooklyn was a big place. But since this girl had shown herself to know more than most, he decided to do as she said. He found that he was suddenly more curious about the future, nearly hopeful, which was something he hadn't felt for many years.
"And what happens when we find her?" he asked.
"Then I'll be where I'm meant to be," Faith said. "And you'll be rich." When they stopped for the night, Faith looked through the cart until she found a handsaw, which she quickly handed over to Finney. She nodded to the iron bracelets. "Work away," she told him. Finney took a step back when he realized that she wished him to saw through the iron bracelets she wore, fitted tightly to her wrists. He didn't have great confidence in the steadiness of his own hands. He often drank to forget and had tremors, along with a lack of faith in himself. And he was a gentle man who hated to cause anyone pain. He shook his head and put down the saw.
"I might hurt you."
"I couldn't be any more hurt than I already am," Faith replied. "I lost everything. You're just helping me find it again. When we get to where we're going, you'll be rewarded. You'll have more than you've ever dreamed of."
"So you say," Finney laughed. "I assume you have hidden riches?"
"I assure you," Faith said, sounding insulted. "My mother will see that you're repaid." When she stared at him so pitifully, he had no choice in the matter. Faith sat perfectly still, and if the handsaw nicked her now and again, she didn't wail or complain, not even when there was a line of blood, which was black and sticky and burned through the floor of the wagon. She had grown up drinking courage tea, and the effects of that brew had lasted. When the bracelets came off, blue marks circled her wrists, and where the skin had been pinched for so long, there were deep indentations in her flesh. She would have these marks all her life, and they would serve to remind her of what some people were willing to do for what they told themselves was love. Faith could feel her power increasing immediately. A breath, a sigh, and she was herself again. She glanced at the sky and knew it would rain if she wished it to. She gazed at Jack Finney, and with the sight was able to see through him to the young man he'd been when he lost his wife and child. She saw the grief he carried with him in a tight web that sat beside his heart. When they stopped to rest, she spied the souls of the murdered Lanapee, the original people who had lived in the marshes, for their spirits had gathered in the blue dusk, and their weeping sounded like the cry of the seabirds. Faith was overcome with emotion, and if she'd been another girl, she might have wept. But instead, she walked out to where Finney couldn't spy her, and she danced as the moon rose. She was herself again, it was true. But she had also been changed. Inside, there was a line of bitterness that reached directly to her heart,
so strong it brought her to the brink of tears. This is who she was. The girl who had climbed through the window to save her own life. They stayed at a farmhouse on Rabbit Island, called Konian Island by the Dutch and Coney Island by the English, referring to the ancient name for these creatures that was used in the King James Bible. It was here, near the seaside, where a Cornish woman named Maud Carty lived on her own. Although she and Jack Finney had forgotten how they were related, they had cousins who were cousins, and she always had a room for him should the need arise. Maud loved Brooklyn, and how wild and lonely it was, for she was wild and lonely as well. She'd come across the ocean because of a man, but that affair had been short-lived, and many other men had been in her life. 40 years had passed since she'd thought of that fellow, except once in a while when the tide was high, or the moon was full, she remembered to be grateful to him. "Who's this?" Maud asked when she saw the strange, dark-haired girl. Maud was suspicious, no matter the circumstances, and wise to be so, for she lived all alone in this odd blue land, where it was possible to see for miles and where robbers and ruined men had settled among the good people of Brooklyn. "I'm his niece," Faith was quick to say. Her gray eyes gave nothing away, but for every lie she told, a white spot appeared on her fingernails. Maud pursed her mouth and studied the girl. She wasn't sure what she was looking at.
"That's who she is," Finney agreed, wondering how he'd ever gotten so involved when he'd spent all his years on this side of the Atlantic having nothing to do with other people.
"Is she now?" Maud had lost a few husbands and children herself, and had a dozen nieces in Cornwall. She knew a bit about the world. There was something else at work here. "She doesn't look a thing like you."
"She's lucky, then," Finney replied. "The good Lord didn't make a mistake there."
That night, Faith slept outside, so that she could see the stars. She thought of men and women who spent years in prison, unable to see the heavens. That did something to you. It drained you inside. In the morning, there were white and red roses growing in the place where Faith had slept. They had bloomed from the withered plants Maud had brought with her from England that had never grown well in the sandy soil. Maud had wondered about Faith from the start. Now she was certain this was no ordinary girl. To be sure she was protected from any witchery, Maud carried a piece of rose quartz she had collected from the beach in Cornwall, a stone that is known to cure most ills. One look at the stone Maud Carty had tucked in her sleeve, and Faith knew she'd been found out. It was best to make friends out of enemies.
"I'd like to repay you for letting me stay," Faith said to the old woman.
"Would you?" Maud said. "Can you make me young again?"
Faith gave her the last bar of the black soap she had made in the cemetery. It wasn't quite her mother's recipe, but it could take a few years off anyone's age.
"Well, I won't be 20 again using that," Maud said.
Faith couldn't debate that fact.
"Then ask me for another favor." And so the two went out in the dark of morning so that Faith could help the old woman chase the rabbits out of her garden. It was a thankless task. For every 10 Maud had chased away, 20 more appeared. Because of these creatures, most of the farms here had failed.
"I can get rid of them, if that's what you wish," Faith said. "But once they're gone, they won't come back."
"Do so." Maud had her hands on her hips. "I won't miss them."
Maud noticed that where the girl's inky hair was parted, there was a pale red line of color showing through. Red-haired people were said to have talents others did not. Perhaps this girl had a knack for making things disappear. The rabbits were multiplying as they stood there, and Maud was interested to see what this girl was capable of. Faith put down salt around the garden as she spoke words Hannah had taught Maria, to keep unwelcome pests out of a garden. It was a Latin spell, and it sounded otherworldly spoken here in the Flatlands. Coming from Cornwall, Maud knew something about the nameless art. She most certainly could spot a witch. As soon as the spell was cast, the rabbits moved on to Maud's neighbor's place, a good 10 miles away. There were so many that the sandy ground shook as they ran east. Impressed, Maud invited Faith into her parlor, her best room, one Jack Finney had never set foot in, for there was a precious Turkish carpet there that was far too good for the peddler to stomp upon with his muddy boots. To Faith's surprise, a black mirror was set upon a small wooden table.
"One favor deserves another," Maud Carty said. "Perhaps you'd like to look into the future."
Maud came from a long line of what people called the cunning folk, not among those born to be a witch, but practiced in healing, descended from a tradition of women who could see what others could not. She'd sat at her grandmother's knee and heard about how to bring a baby along when it refused to be born, and how to save a man in the throes of a fever. Faith sat in a hard-backed wooden chair and gazed into the mirror that had belonged to Maud's grandmother in the time when not many could afford mirrors. It was an old piece, in use for more than 50 years. And though the glass was silvered, and the black paint thick and peeling, its power was strong. Many women had seen what was to come when looking into it, for it was pure and asked for nothing in return. Faith placed her elbows on the table and looked down. Immediately she felt as if she were being pulled under water. There was the lake with no bottom, and the serpent she'd fed crusts of bread, and the blue-green sea they had crossed while aboard the Queen Esther. There was the marsh where Martha Chase lay dying, her eyes fluttering open to see how bright the world was before she left it behind. In that black mirror, Faith saw the time she'd been away pass quickly, like pages turned in a book. 5 years that had vanished in the blink of an eye. For all this time, Keeper had searched New York for her. He was full grown now, not a leggy, skinny, half-starved creature, but her familiar, her heart and soul, in pain over his loss. When he howled at night, those who heard him shivered in their beds, well aware that there was never a dog that made such mournful cries. Faith could hear him now, across the water, her other, her familiar, who had chosen her. She dove in deeper as she stared into the glass, so deep that all she saw was underwater, both the present and the past. Floating there between worlds, she could spy her mother in the silk morning dress she had worn ever since she'd lost Faith, a black veil shielding her face. She saw Maria walking through the muddy streets, crying, even though it is said witches cannot cry. They can, but doing so changes them and leaves them unprotected, for that's what real love can do. Faith was drowning in the black mirror, going deeper and deeper. She held her breath. She peered through the murk of the muddy currents. She had come to the river of hell, a dark, bottomless canal that was filled with bodies of those who could not swim. Faith might have never surfaced. She might have been trapped there inside her mind, drowning in that cold, brackish place, if Maud Carty hadn't grasped her arm and firmly pulled her away from the table.
"That's enough, girl," Maud said. "Let's get you back here."
Faith gasped, and when she did, she spat out river water. Maud went off to retrieve her smelling salts, so she might revive the child. She returned to find that Faith was dripping wet, a pool of black water around her feet. Whatever she was, whoever she was, Maud knew she was powerful. The girl's face shone and her hair was damp. Faith's heart was pounding because of the flash of vision she'd seen.
"Where did you go off to?" Maud asked the child.
"It's on the other side of the river that crosses hell," Faith replied. She had no idea where that was, only that her mother was there waiting. She'd been waiting all along. Faith didn't need any more answers. Her mouth was set, and she felt fearless, as if she had consumed a pot of courage tea. She felt like a bird that was about to fly away from this cloudy blue countryside.
"That's where I must go," she told Maud.
"I know the place," Maud informed her, pleased she could figure out the puzzle of the girl's vision. The East River was divided by Hellgate, a natural rock sill where there were swift currents and jutting ledges that had caused many ships to sink and many men to drown. Still, it was the way to cross over to the docks that were teeming with sailors.
"You'll be wanting to go to Manhattan," Maud Cardy told Faith.
"And if anything's a vision, it's that city. Remember, once you're there, keep your purse closed and your eyes open, and every wonder will be there to see."